From the White Letter Production Studios in Los Angeles, California, I'm Eli Unger Sargon.
And I'm Jeff Helmreich.
And this is Four Qubits. So last time, Jeff, we were going through Taylor's stages of modern racialism. And just as a quick recap for our audience, we had the early modern period, which was the time of colonies and slavery. This was the monogenist, you know, they still saw humanity as one race, but they saw a kind of dilution down from Adam, so that you had white people at the top, and then as you dilute down to the bottom, you get to black people. And in Taylor's schema, this period, the early modern racialist period, was naturalizing difference, right? It was trying to sort of look at these differences between racial groups and make it into something natural. We talked about Linnaeus. Then we had the high modern or classical racial thinking. And we talked about Taylor's five suppositions of classical racialism. And here we have polygenism coming in. This is also the time of the Enlightenment thinking. So it's trying to rationalize, not just naturalize, the differences between the races. And in this period, of course, we have eventually the Holocaust and the horrors of the Nazi regime. Taylor then has the late modern racialism period in, and we talked about the U.S. versus Thind case and the UNESCO report. And here he talks about, you know, whereas in the early modern period, we had a naturalization of difference, and in the high modern period, we had a rationalization of difference. Here in the late modern period, Taylor talks about the politicization of difference. And you can think in this period, of course, of the era of civil rights legislation, and of course, Black Power in the 60s and the 70s. And that brings us to the era in which we were born, Jeff, which is what Taylor calls the postmodern racialism. And postmodern racialism is different. It's a much more subtle situation where the signpost that he has here, remember we talked about signposts and watershed moments, and the signpost that he has here is this really interesting speech that Ronald Reagan gives in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1980. Now, he's in the midst of a heated campaign against Jimmy Carter, and this place, Philadelphia, Mississippi, was famous because 16 years earlier, during the civil rights movement, three civil rights activists were abducted and murdered by the KKK. And they were eventually apprehended. And one of the things that they proclaimed publicly was that they had been acting in the interests of states' rights. So this was all very fresh in the memory of the country. And Reagan gives a speech here in 1980 in this spot in which he defends states' rights.
I believe in states' rights. I believe in people doing as much as they can for themselves at the community level and the private level. And I believe that we've distorted the balance of our government today by giving powers that were never intended in the Constitution to that federal establishment. And if I do get the job I'm looking for, trying to reorder those priorities.
And when Carter then calls him on this, right, and interprets it as a kind of coded support for a return to Jim Crow, Reagan accuses Carter of race bait. In a nutshell, this is postmodern racialism. So overt racism is no longer acceptable, but coded appeals kind of become the order of the day. And anyone who talks about race and racism is sort of castigated as part of the problem. They're the race baiters. They're the people who are the real problem. We colorblind people, we don't see race, right? And so that sort of ushers in this era of postmodern racialism. And honestly, this is what I grew up with. This is what you grew up with. You know, this sort of starts in the 80s and goes in many ways, you know, you could argue until, let's say, the election of Barack Obama or after.
Right. But when we say overt racism is no longer acceptable, I wonder if that means, starting in 1980, that nobody regards racism as an acceptable idea, or that nobody regards racism as something you can socially accept, something you can say in public. Because throughout the 1980s, as I recall, many whites expressed racism. It was always unearthed, and it was a scandal when it was unearthed. But you'd find people at the highest levels of power, including somebody in Reagan's administration who was fired for this, saying, you know, the kind of stuff we saw with Steve Bannon in our time. You'd find these quotes and these, you know, the revelations always said in private that somehow got loose and made me think, well, yeah, racism was not considered polite, not considered acceptable in public. But I wonder how illegitimate it was as an idea. Racism at the time might have been what today we consider political incorrectness, something that, you know, not everybody agrees expresses a mistaken sentiment, but everyone knows it's not something that it's in some sense accepted if you say it. So I'm wondering if that's what he means by overt racism, but covert racism thrived. Or was it that people really sincerely believe, for the most part, that they didn't see color, even as they unconsciously, implicitly, in all other ways, entrenched racial hierarchies?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point, because one of the things that you lose when you start breaking things down into these kinds of eras, it gives a sort of illusion that the earlier forms of racism cease to exist or poof out of existence. And that's not exactly what's going on here. And I do think that it's important to point that out, right? So we're in 2021 right now, but I know people who, to my face, express what in this schema should have gone out with classical racialism, right? I'm sure you've had experiences of that too. So these ideas, while they are no longer kind of acceptable in certain intellectual circles, which have an enormous amount of political power, they continue to exist among people. And you'll find a complete mix, right? There's just sort of a swirl of all these ideas that are part of the culture. And even if, you know, sort of the official structures of intellectual power have moved on to another model, and certain kinds of thinking and certain kinds of talking aren't generally accepted, lots of people still think that way. Lots of people are still persuaded by classical racialism to this day.
Right. And they're not ashamed of it in company they consider to be their own. So when talking amongst themselves in private, social gatherings, you know, dinners, get-togethers, I don't think it's necessarily gone. You know, I'd have to do a larger study. But in fact, it might not even be subtle or hidden in any way. It might just be the sort of thing that, like, you know, I mean, think of fat shaming. Think of, you know, making fun of people because of their appearance or their weight or something like that. This is one of those things that you don't do in public. You know it's rude. You know it's offensive. But far too many people feel free to do so in private. And it's not as if when they do it, they think they're doing something illegitimate or wrong or something indefensible. They just know the rules. The rules are you don't do that in public. You don't do that in certain company. And you know it's a little bit offensive. But sometimes you get to say offensive things in the right setting or after a drink or something along those lines. I mean, I think it might be in that category, and it's important because this tells us how alive the idea is, how conscious it is, and therefore whether the target of most of our efforts today ought to be unconscious and unintended racism, so to speak, or intended racism.
That's right. And before we move on to the meat and potatoes of this discussion and we start talking about definitions, I wanted to just give a nod to a couple of things that our walk through Taylor's stages of modern racialism didn't quite cover. And the first is the role of religion in racial thinking. It's a peculiar thing. There are two axes I want to look at here. The first is sort of religious thinking, and the second is Enlightenment thinking. And the depressing fact of the matter, I think, Jeff, is that they both are sort of culpable here in perpetuating a kind of racial way of thinking about humanity. And the way it manifested in religion was in a very peculiar passage from the Bible. Are you familiar with the curse of Ham, Jeff?
This is in Genesis after the flood, where he angered his father and he's one of Noah's sons, right?
That's right. Noah, after the flood and after the ark and all of that, he settles down and, you know, he has this treaty with God. And he plants a vineyard and makes himself a little vino, and he gets drunk. And his son, Ham, who I guess in English it's Ham, we're told he sees his nakedness and he tells his brothers of his father's nakedness. And this is very bad. And the brothers cover up their father's nakedness and walk backwards so they don't see it. And then when, you know, Noah is sober, he curses Ham. He curses Ham, who is the father of the Canaanites. And the curse involves slavery, that you will be a slave to your brothers. And in this passage, it's peculiar for a whole bunch of reasons. But this then kind of gets taken and run with. So the rabbis of the Talmud and the Medrash, they're like, well, it can't just be that he saw him naked, right? There's got to be something else going on here. Like, that's just seeing your father naked. Like, what's going on here? So they say that he sodomized him. They say that he castrated him. Like, they sort of go to these extremes. But in the popular consciousness, is a weird thing that happens, because the word cham is close in Hebrew to the word chum, which means brown. In the popular consciousness, people start associating Ham, this son of Noah, with people of dark skin. And then also there's a midrashic tie-in here in the Jewish tradition, where there's a direct connection made between this son of Noah and the Cushites. And this eventually gets taken up by the Islamic thinkers and, importantly, by Christian thinkers as a justification for slavery. I sort of vaguely remember this story when I was growing up, you know, in religious context, but these sorts of explicit connections to racial thinking and all that sort of thing, I don't have for my childhood. Did you get that?
No, certainly. I mean, I've met religious racists of all stripes and religions, and I've met religious anti-racists of all stripes, and both of them find in religion of tremendous inspiration for their racist or anti-racist views. Anti-racists draw on religion, the idea of equality and created equal, and an equalization that transcends tribes. And they say this is an innovation in certain biblical texts, the idea that you should love the stranger, that all humans are created in God's image, not just the particular humans. But then you've got, obviously, racial thinkers who go the other way, and they quote things. And it gets to the point where I feel, at least, you know, whether you can be Reverend Martin Luther King or one of those reverends, or Reverend Robertson or whoever, I think what ends up happening is religion serves as a kind of mirror or a kind of tool of the sentiments that are already there.
Yeah. And I mean, for obvious historical reasons, Jews never had, I shouldn't say that. I was about to say Jews never had the opportunity to really, you know, engage in slavery, but that's not true. I actually edit the podcast of a mutual friend of ours, Rabbi Aryeh Cohen. It's called Daf Shvui. He does a page of Talmud every week, and we're in the tractate of Bava Batra. And in Bava Batra, there's discussion of ownership. And the rabbis definitely had a concept of slavery built directly into their concept of ownership.
Right. There was slavery in ancient times. And and every society had rules of slavery, the same way you had rules of property and rules of labor, because it was this hybrid of property and labor that had application. And so there were rules about it. There were conditions for it. It wasn't, you know, slavery was just plain not unacceptable until very recently in our history. And there are some who vaguely question it now, question the absolute unacceptability of slavery even today, if you can believe it. So it's not surprising that every culture and every religion and every tribe that we know today had members involved in or acquiescing in owning slaves.
Yeah, and this is a really important point that I think bears emphasis. I'm going to quote now from a Moroccan Islamic scholar named An-Nasiri. And in the Islamic world, there was a form of slavery that was well established when the transatlantic slave trade started by the Europeans. In many ways, it was not as harsh as the transatlantic slavery, but it was nonetheless slavery. And this is what An-Nasiri has to say. And this is important to note, he's criticizing Muslims for enslaving other Muslims and racializing on that basis. And this is what he has to say. People have become so inured, generation after generation, that many common folk believe that the reason for being enslaved according to holy law is merely that a man should be black in color and come from those regions. And the reason I wanted to bring up this quote is, first of all, to sort of nod in the direction of, you know, this other world of slavery, which is fascinating, the Islamic slave trade, which actually had a direct impact on how the European and transatlantic slave trade developed. But more importantly, to talk about what I see as a kind of feedback loop where you have an institution like slavery that needs to be justified by ideas. And so you have the institution, and then you have ideas, and the ideas feeds back into the institution in this feedback loop. And this is a point that Kendi brings up. Actually, Kendi would go a little further. He wouldn't talk about a feedback loop. For Kendi, he thinks that it's best that we talk about the relationship between racist thought and racial institutions in one direction, right? That intuitively, we might think that slavery comes from racial thinking or racist thinking. But what he says is you should think about it in the opposite direction, that actually racial thinking is a product of slavery, that it's there to justify slavery. And I think that's a really interesting kind of reversal.
It's interesting. It's also in other ways rather typical, right? Because there's a very popular way of looking at things in contemporary academic circles where economic motives are always taken to be this. These are orthodoxies in academia today. One of them is that economic or class-based class hierarchy is the ultimate motivator, and ulterior class motivations actually drive everything else. Nothing seems to move people as much as material envy and or material greed is one orthodoxy of contemporary academia. And the second is that a lot, whenever something serves the aim or the ends of economic greed of one sort or another, it is actually the underlying motive and the driver of what seems to be something else. So anything that's any political order that an ostensible political order that actually entrenches a certain economic hierarchy, it turns out by magic that economic hierarchy was intended to be entrenched by the political order. It was done on purpose. And of course, the underlying motive was the economic greed. I don't know where this started, but there's some kind of view that academics love in which everybody is obsessed with having and making sure that they have more than someone else, that this is a very universal and powerful drive of people. Maybe because academics are very acquisitive, I don't know, but they have this idea. And so when they see, oh my God, slavery was very beneficial in these ways, and racial thinking serves the aim of slavery, so it must be that the economic aim of slavery motivated racial thinking. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily just because it fits into an academic template that seems almost universally, you know, almost pathologically and obsessively to be applied, means it's false. It might not be false. But whenever that option is on the table, academics have a tendency. And I'm an academic, so I don't mean this in a form of bigotry. Well, it wouldn't be of academy trashing, but
we'll get to that.
It's hard. It's often hard to know, and it's a purely causal, purely empirical question. I sincerely doubt we could answer it one or the other with too much authority today, and I strongly suspect that people are a little bit too tempted by the answer that this economic driver that puts people that benefits people a certain way was the motivation. I think there's plenty of evidence that people thought racially for the rather uninterestingly similar reasons they thought tribally for centuries, and thought in terms of superiority of their own tribe, which later got sort of transposed through the lens of racialism into their own race being superior. But it was always them, they're superior, and others are inferior. And there's probably a combination of causal directions one way and the other on this.
Yeah, that's why I prefer the feedback loop metaphor, because I really do think that both feed into each other. And that Nasiri quote, I think, beautifully demonstrates that also. There was an element of racialization in the Islamic slave trade as well. And so, yeah, I think a feedback loop where these institutions that have powerful incentives feed into the way people think about their groups. And as you were saying, and as we talked about last time, there was ample and fertile ground that pre-existed racial thinking for it to kind of layer itself over.
And remember, slavery itself was entirely legitimate anyway at that time in history. I mean, it wasn't legitimate, obviously, it was terrible, but it was entirely accepted. It wasn't controversial yet, as it should have been. What probably was very driving was that certain people were weaker. And colonialism in general was based on all kinds of notions of superiority and all kinds of exploitation. People that weren't enslaved were exploited in other ways by the colonists who engaged in the slave trade. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of factors here that sort of conspire together in nefarious ways. And it's hard to know which is driving which, because they all work so diabolically well together.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we leave history and start talking philosophy proper, I just wanted to mention, because I think I didn't realize until I started digging back into the sources, just how much a part of the Enlightenment project racial thinking was. And I'm starting to realize that it's, you know, that you could very easily fall into a kind of false thinking that, you know, well, this was an element of Enlightenment thinking, but it wasn't really at the center, or wasn't really that important, or they didn't really, like, it was sort of a peripheral part. No, I think from what I'm reading now, this was a central part of the project, and it was a part of the way that Europe was kind of teaching themselves about the world, and it was through these racial lenses.
So there I want you to say a little bit more, because I see the Enlightenment going in two directions here. There's the fact that many Enlightenment, the leaders, you know, Enlightenment was a movement led by towering thinkers and ideas, the authors of which were in many cases also racists and engaged in racial thinking that was rationalized by the same kind of Enlightenment methods by which everything that they believed was rationalized. And so there you have that aspect. But the content, the substantive content of what was innovative and new about the Enlightenment included some very important views that I think we owe the outgrowing of racism that we had in the 20th century to. I think the fight against racism, the fight against and the fight for equality, I think they owe something to Enlightenment ideas, particularly those of individualism and reason. I mean, the kind of universalism and individualism, the idea that a person can transcend and think their way out of and act their way out of the context in which they were birthed, in which they were developed, in which they were grown, is very important. I think the fact that it's gone out of fashion today is depriving us very harmfully of a lot of the tools we otherwise have against racism today. You know, in the Enlightenment, is a double-edged sword. I mean, we do get a lot of bad from it, and a lot of rationalization of evil. But we also get some of the ideas that are essential to the fact that any of us even have the idea not to be racist or to fight racism today. We owe that, I think, in its entirety to the Enlightenment, just as much as we owe a lot of racial thinking to the Enlightenment.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm going to read a few quotes here. So David Hume, 1753, right. I'm going to quote here.
Of course.
I am apt to suspect the Negroes and in general all the other species of man, for there are four or five different kinds, to be naturally inferior to the whites. There never was a civilized nation of any other complexion than white, nor even any individual eminent either in action or speculation. In Jamaica, indeed, they talk of one Negro as a man of parts and learning, but it is likely he is admired for slender accomplishments, like a parrot who speaks a few words plainly. So that's Hume.
Right. That's very
infamous. Here we have Kant. Humanity is at its greatest perfection in the race of the whites. The yellow Indians do have a meager talent. The Negroes are far below them and at the lowest point are a part of the American peoples. And then finally, Hegel. The Negro is an example of an animal man in all his savagery and lawlessness. And I'm bringing these quotes in because I'm actually persuaded by Kennedy's argument here. And Kennedy's, of course, focused in his book Stamped on the American context, but he devotes an enormous amount of time to Thomas Jefferson, who was a very important founding father in the United States and had certainly read all of these people and was a slaver.
Right. But I mean, so the problem with this is I think it conflates things like constitutionalism, liberalism, you know, rights theory and all that with the thinkers who happened to have founded or led these movements. And, you know, the movement is one thing. The people who led them and who are icons of it is something else. And one of the things that, you know, nobody says when discussing the major contributions that Hume made to our thinking, even before the 20th century, when obviously, you know, when we reached the Taylor's postmodern, when racialism is no longer legitimate, even before that, nobody says Hume brought us, you know, the critique of causation, the thinking, he brought us skepticism, and he brought us this great division of things into races. What they probably would have said, what I think they'd rightly say, is that in some ways he contributed to new intellectual movements and the genesis of new ideas, new ways of thinking. And in other ways, he reflected the old ways, the old and bad ways of thinking that were characteristic of his time, characteristic of many people like him. I wouldn't credit movements that Hume and Hegel and Kant happened to be in with standing for the things that they otherwise happened to think. It'd have to be that here's what we mean to espouse with the Enlightenment, racialism. If that's what they said explicitly, then fine. But if the innovate, you judge an intellectual movement by what it innovated, what it added, what it changed. And again, I think still a lot of bad, but individualism and rationalism are essential these days to anti-racism. And so we have to keep that in mind, I think. Just like equality thinking is a lot more important in some ways than the people who first espoused it and who very hypocritically owned slaves.
I think the point that Kendi was making, and I am persuaded by this, is that it's not just an accident that these people ended up, you know, writing the Declaration of Independence and, you know, shaped the destiny of the United States, in the case of Thomas Jefferson, in a very particular way, relying heavily on people like David Hume, Immanuel Kant, you know, in other contexts, it would have been Hegel, Linnaeus, we talked about last time. I don't see this as a coincidence.
But where in the ideas of Kant that they used to ground the Constitution is Kant's racism?
No, they feel comfortable excluding an entire group of people based on the foundations of racial thinking that you find across the board in all these Enlightenment thinkers.
Right. But do you find them in the ideas of the Enlightenment that made them think we're going to have equality of this kind, or we're going to have rights of this kind, or is it, do they find it acceptable for the same reason those thinkers were accepted? Because all of these thinkers failed to extend their ideas far beyond their own creed and their own whiteness. I mean, they did fail. They all failed. But it's not as if the ideas by which they extended it beyond where it had been before them contain the seeds of exclusion already in those ideas. To make that argument, you'd have to find it in the content. You'd have to find it in the text.
I'm saying that it's an innovation, right? We've covered this in our non-exhaustive walk through racial thinking. Racial thinking is an innovation of the Enlightenment thinkers.
How
this
so?
Is not...
Was Hume adding to what was thought of beforehand?
They were all innovating in the sense of dividing humanity into these races. Again, like we have a tendency to think in terms of racial progress, and even, you know, these phases that we talked about, the stages of modern racialism that Taylor talks about, gives a kind of sense that there's progress being made. And I think Taylor would agree, and I agree, progress is made at certain points. But I mean, the whole notion of races in the way that they developed in Enlightenment Europe was not progress.
No, of course not. No, we don't disagree about how unenlightened, in terms of this crucial immorality, Enlightenment thinkers like Kant and Hume actually were. They were unenlightened in these ways. I want to resist the temptation to somehow read that into the progressive parts of their thoughts too, so that everything that they contributed is somehow working hand in hand with their regressive thinking. I think a more natural reading is to say they reflected traces of the repressive and horrible racist views that persisted through their age, but they tried. However, they tried to transcend some of the prejudices of their time, crafting a movement that would have to evolve ultimately to extend far beyond their limited imaginations. I don't want to, however, read the very racism that limited their imaginations into the progress they tried to make. I think it's a function. Yes, Jefferson owned slaves, and it's horrible. It's scandalous. But I think it is a coincidence, for lack of a better word, that he espoused certain kinds of ideologies that really can't be read except as condemning slavery. It's hypocrisy.
No, but so here the history becomes very important, because he really didn't do much to get rid of slavery, and he had ample opportunity, and there were other people in that milieu who were working to get rid of slavery. So it's not, there's no accident here at all.
No, the accident is that egalitarianism that he preached happens, ideas that he signed on to, that he in some cases crafted, really do condemn slavery. I don't think we can read them somehow to not condemn slavery by virtue of who he happened to be. I think what we say is he was a hypocrite. He was a hypocrite.
I see. So I see what you're saying. Yeah.
And therefore, the Enlightenment movement, it is just plain irrelevant to what that movement stood for and innovated, what its leading thinkers happened to also think. And I emphasize also think. The things that Hume thought about race weren't part of the Enlightenment. The thing that Kant thought about race weren't part of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was, despite some of the anti-Enlightenment ideas in its leading thinkers and icons. And so it's not that Kendi is wrong by this, that he's perfectly wrong. It is precisely a coincidence.
What is the fallacy called? No true Scotsman?
What fallacy?
There's a fallacy where I think it's called no true Scotsman. But the idea...
Where is it being implicated here?
I frequently hear it in conversations about religion. You know, when certain kinds of Christians get criticized for something, they'll say, well, that person isn't a real Christian. So I feel like I'm getting a little bit of that from you here. Well, that's not the real Enlightenment.
No, but I would say that when Christians get criticized for shoplifting, I'd say, okay, no, they are Christians, but Christianity isn't a pro-shoplifting religion, or it's no coincidence that Christians shoplift. No, I think you really can say that Christianity doesn't stand for shoplifting, even if every Christian shoplifts. It's, you know, you have to find it in Christianity. Again, I think there is, now I'm pushing this because I think there's a tendency here to read motives in, because it, you know, it has this cool black is white, up is down, we're through the looking glass feel about it. Like, you thought the Enlightenment was this, it's really that. Aha. No, it's not quite. This is just, it's going too far. The Enlightenment was complicated, but you can't trace its ideas. It's not enough to say. If you could say, and this is actually a point that is made by some people today, if you could say that liberal Enlightenment thinking, universal thinking, was actually by its very content, even its most innovative parts, a way of entrenching existing hierarchies. Because by being blind to how things actually turn out, by pretending to be universal, it actually entrenches. It actually puts the blame for how things turn out on groups that find themselves at the bottom. It's a way of resisting actual wealth redistribution, actual far more egalitarian schemes. I mean, Enlightenment thinking has been blamed for a kind of neoliberalism that pushes ideas like colorblindness and you know, sort of naive notions of neutrality that are often just a kind of a disguise, or at least an excuse to avoid changing the situation, to avoid changing the power structure. And that is a critique of Enlightenment and universal liberalism that is based on the actual content of the ideas that most distinguish the Enlightenment. But just the ad hominem thing of, like, those people who founded and innovated the Enlightenment ideas also thought X, Y, and Z, so let's kind of say the Enlightenment was actually all about X, Y, Z, that I think is a fallacy.
So I'm definitely not trying to make an ad hominem argument here. I don't think Kendi does with Jefferson either. I think he actually tracks his legislative record and demonstrates that his political actions, which were very consequential, aligned perfectly with these racialist Enlightenment ideas and had consequences for slavery and racial inequity in the United States.
They certainly aligned with that. I mean, owning slaves and the legislation he did, I agree. His actions, all of them. But what are racialist Enlightenment ideas? Because that's what I'm having trouble with. I can see ideas that Enlightenment thinkers also had, but what makes them Enlightenment ideas is what I'm asking.
Well, you know, Taylor argues that they were no longer naturalizing difference. They were rationalizing difference. And they were making all sorts of claims about who has reason and who can have reason. And I think that strikes at the heart of the Enlightenment project. If you are investing reason and rational thinking and individuality with as much weight as Enlightenment thinkers are, and then you're saying this group of people can't do it, that's a big deal. That's not peripheral. That's not just, you know, a little side hypocrisy. That's central to your project. You're dividing the world into people who can achieve reason and people who can't. By the way, the Enlightenment thinkers weren't the first people to do that. The medieval Islamic philosophers did something similar. They were relying on Aristotle and his concepts of, you know, natural slaves, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, there's a history of doing this sort of thing, and the Enlightenment thinkers did it the worst.
Well, I don't know if they did it the worst. The Inquisition was arguably an instance of it pre-Enlightenment. There were plenty of I mean, every age, whatever it is that people thought was most important for humans to achieve and human excellence, unfortunately, most ages in which there were ideas of human excellence and human ideals, people had theories about why certain humans, those people, couldn't achieve them. So when we got to the Enlightenment and reason and, you know, reason individualism was the thing, it's not surprising that the same racists who would have in previous generations said, you know, they're not in the image of God, or, you know, they're not, they don't have the ideal blood, are now saying they don't have reason. But again, maybe this is just a trivial question about what ideas of Enlightenment thinkers do we equate with the Enlightenment itself, and what ideas do we say were tragically also espoused and harbored by them. But to me, it's not part of the idea of individualism and rationalism that certain races or groups don't have it. I think that's, if anything, a limitation of a project that, if taken to its conclusion, would have been much better, would have been much more consistent. Like the project of the U.S. Constitution, I think the ideas behind it really have been used to justify abolishing the segregation and slavery practiced by those who first coined it, who framed the Constitution. And what we say about them, I think, rightly, is they didn't take their own ideas to their logical conclusion, or they didn't practice their own ideas fully.
That's our show. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to email us at 4qubitspodcast@gmail.com. You can check us out on the web at www.4qubits.net. And you can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.